You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. Talking Atlanta Braves with Mark Bowman. We'll be taking a look at Mike Foltynewicz's strange and scary health issues, Julio Teheran's hot streak, and revisiting Hector Oliveira. Talking Miami Marlins with Joe Fusaro, and we're taking a look at the continually developing manager and general manager situations. Talking New York Mets with Anthony DiComo, I'll be asking whether there's reason to worry, and then we'll talk about setting up the postseason rotation in the bullpen. Talking Philadelphia Phillies with Todd Zielecki, and we'll be getting into a lot of depth on the GM search, what they may be looking for and what they may be able to get. And talking Washington Nationals with Bill Ladson, talking about why the Nats struggle against good teams, especially on the offensive side. The Mets don't have as much of a lengthy, tortured history as some organizations, and yet fans and even some of the coverage act like they do. I mean, obviously there was one big one a few years back, but anyway, this is a very long way of prefacing a question, which is there any worry in that clubhouse right now, or is this all kind of manufactured and external?
In the clubhouse, no. There's no ultimate worry that, you know, they're going to suffer some massive collapse and it's going to be 2007 but worse. It's sort of a fatalist view that I think a lot of fans have, and for good reason. And I think, you know, in their heart of hearts, a lot of fans don't actually believe the Mets are going to collapse, because we've reached a place really where the Nationals are playing so poorly, continuing to play so poorly, that it's just, you know, it's not going to happen. It can't happen, despite how poorly the Mets are playing as well. But, you know, it's just the history here, and it's the recent history. It's the 2007, up seven games with 17 to play. It's up 2008, which wasn't that bad, but it was still a pretty sizable collapse. And, well, yeah, they're not the Cubs. They don't have that history. They do have a history of being pretty good and not necessarily making it. And what I mean by that is, it's not like, you know, the Cubs, who can go decades at a time without putting a team on the field that has a chance. You know, the Mets have never really had a super long stretch where they haven't had a chance, because historically they've always had really good pitching, just like they do this year. And you look at the history of pitchers that have come through this franchise, from Seaver to Gooden, Kuzman, and so on and so forth, even more in modern day, you know, Johan Santana, and guys like that, now Harvey, DeGrom, it's hard to have an extended patch of losing when you have pitching like that. The Mets have it. That's why the expectations are high. And ultimately, that's why they're not going to collapse. That's why they haven't. That's why they've reached a point where it's pretty much impossible now, because the pitching is so good. And anyone who follows this team on a daily basis probably knows that, you know, this team is limping into the playoffs a little bit. There are some issues with that rotation, with the way they've been used, with how fresh they are, with how they're performing down the stretch, and so on and so forth. There's certainly some issues with the bullpen. And, you know, if it doesn't correct itself over the next 10 days, you do worry about this team coming into the playoffs. But in terms of it being fair to sort of see this team as a club that's going to collapse or should have collapsed or whatever, hey, this team played really good all year, and just the fact that they're limping down the stretch here, probably going to quote-unquote back into the playoffs, shouldn't really undermine what they've done for the first 5.5 months, or really what they've done, you know, since the end of July until about a week ago, which is play as good, if not better, than any other team in the league.
And because you're such a pro, you set me up beautifully for both of the next two things I want to ask about. The big one to me, I mean, the bullpen gets all the attention, and you lose games late in the late innings, and that's what happens. But to me, the really big question for this club going into October is the rotation. I mean, there's just sort of the overall picture that in general they haven't been that great in recent weeks, but I think there's a more specific question of who's in a postseason rotation. I know it's something that's sort of an ongoing question, but, you know, the two guys that you might be least sure that were going to be in there, Mats and Colon, are the two guys who are pitching really well here lately. How do they fit these pieces together? And I guess the big question is, how do they balance the sort of overall known ability level of these guys. We know Matt Harvey's really good. We know Jacob DeGrom's really good. With the sort of short term, some of these guys, as you say, limping to the finish line a little bit.
Well, I don't think Cologne is in, and that's for a couple different reasons. One is you look at the staff, you look at their options, you look at who they have, and there are four guys whose upside just shine bigger and brighter than anyone else, and that's obviously Matt Harvey, Jacob DeGrom, Noah Syndergaard, and Steven Matt. So if you're drawing up a playoff rotation, barring something you see down the stretch that's terribly worrying, I don't think you can justify leaving any of those four out of it. So where does that leave Cologne? That leaves him in a position where he's a very necessary piece for the bullpen. And, it's almost surprising to me to be saying that because of where he stood a month ago. But he's done really well down the stretch. Granted, it's been against almost exclusively bad teams. I think a lot of people around the Mets would have liked to have seen him pitch against the Yankees a couple weekends ago, only because that would have... it's really the only good team they've played down the stretch, the only playoff caliber team they've played down the stretch. So it would have been interesting to see how he came out of that. But the fact is he has pitched well. The fact is he's had a couple starts like this week where, he's really just dominant early and phased toward the end. So it strikes me as a guy who could potentially do well in the bullpen. And I think you need him in the bullpen because you look at what they have. You have Jacob DeGrom, who has struggled probably for about a month now. He's your game one starter. And, if he keeps struggling, you're going to need someone to back him up. You've got Matt Harvey, who well documented what his limitations are and have been. And while the Mets are saying, he's going to be good to go in the playoffs, what does that mean? And you're going to have a guy who hasn't pitched more than five innings in about a month, and you're going to throw him out there and expect him to go 7-8. Another guy that's valuable to have, a backup like Cologne down there. Same for Noah Syndergaard. Well, he's sort of turned a corner again and has started pitching well. You don't know for sure. This guy's pitching more innings than he ever has in his life. He has a history of giving you some short outings. You don't know when it's going to come and so on and so forth. So while he's a great weapon down there and could easily give you a dominant start, probably has the best stuff on the staff at this point, it's a question. And then Steven Matz, who just has very, very little career experience, and also a history of going short in games. So you've got these four guys who I think need to be in the rotation, who I think ultimately will be in the rotation, but questions for every single one of them in terms of how far they can go. That's why I think Bartolo Colon is so valuable out of the bullpen. That's why I think John Neese, while he's not quite in the spot, in the catbird seat that Colon is, so to speak, I think, he could edge his way into the bullpen for those reasons. You've got Sean Gilmartin, who can give you multiple innings down there. Especially with Carlos Torres, you don't know exactly what the status of his calf injury is and if he's going to be able to help you in October. So the fact that, we've talked so much about the Mets and their back-end bullpen and Reed, Clippard, and Familia, and that's a whole other issue with how those three, or really those two, I would say Clippard and Familia, have struggled a little bit lately. We've talked about how dominant they've been and how dominant they can be in October, but I think, if you're the Mets, you want to concentrate the rest of that bullpen on guys who can pick up your starting pitchers, because you might have a game in the NLDS where your starter goes, 4 2/3, and you need to figure out a way to get to the back end in a game that might be winnable. So it's going to be interesting to see how they put the pieces together. But when I look at the rotation, you got to put your four best guys out there. To me, it's those four young guys, and then there's a clear drop off before you get to Cologne.
Bill, I was looking at what's been going on for the Nats here recently, and I was really struck by a number I came across. And to some extent, it's kind of a breakdown you'd expect from any team. You're going to do better against weaker teams than you are against stronger teams. That's why weaker teams lose more games. But if you go back over the last 8 weeks or so, there's some striking numbers about the Nationals. They are, by my count, 3-19 in their last 22 games against teams that could even charitably be called contenders: Orioles, Mets, Cardinals, Giants, Dodgers, Mets again, Pirates. Against teams that are not just out of it, they're 3-19 over the last 8 weeks. And meanwhile, they've been 25-11 against teams that are completely out of it. With the acknowledgement, again, that to some extent, that's just kind of how it goes. You beat bad teams more than you beat good teams. What do you think it is about this Nationals team as currently constructed that they have had such a hard time beating the better teams on their schedule?
Matthew, it's been a problem all year. Part of the problem is they can't beat the top pitchers. When I mean the top pitchers, I'm talking about the Greinkes of the world, the Kershaws of the world, and I'm telling you, the Nationals have had a tough time against those type of pitchers. And why that is, I think part of it is they have too many hitters who are strikeout artists. There's no question in my mind about that. You don't have guys who work to count, and other than Spand and Jason Wirth, but other than that, everyone else, and Bryce Harper, everyone else is a strikeout artist. So that's part of the problem, in my opinion.
How much, and look, he's missed in a lot of ways, but you note Spann in particular. When it comes to games like that, when it comes to beating good teams and good pitchers, is Spann's absence magnified in those kinds of situations?
Yes, and there's no doubt about it, because here's a guy, he's a true leadoff hitter. He's the best leadoff hitter the Nationals have ever had. And he was missed in a big way, not just offensively, but defensively. But you ask me offensively, he's a guy that, other than Jason Wirth, doesn't work to count the leadoff spot. And that's a problem. And, he could provide some power when he wants to. And the guy's a clutch hitter, too, and he was missed in that way.
The Nationals are interesting. I mean, they're kind of a three true outcomes offense. They are they're third in the National League in home runs. They are near the top in walks. They're near the top in strikeouts. And that was a really good way to win games 10 years ago. It's still not a bad way. I mean, home runs are still a really good way to win, and drawing walks is important. But in this offensive environment, it is more important than ever just to be able to put the ball in play to get singles, to get base hits. There's not a lot they will be able to do to their offense over this winter. I think the bigger priority will likely be filling the holes in the pitching staff from guys who will leave and addressing the rotation, addressing the bullpen. But are there things they can do? Are there places they can look in the offseason to address that contact deficit on their offense?
No doubt about it. They need a catcher. Wilson Ramos he's been healthy. You can't say bad knees were the reason for his bad year. He was healthy all year, and he hasn't been playing good defense. He hasn't been great with the bat either. I think they need to look at maybe a third baseman. Yes, Escobar is doing well offensively. Defensively, he's not been good. And then you also got to hope that Ryan Zimmerman can be healthy. He hasn't been healthy in 3 years. So, I mean, I think that's a big deal. And I think that, you know, somehow, some way, other than Harper and Michael Taylor, you know, I love Jason Wirth. I think he's the unofficial captain of the team. But he has to improve in left field, because he's had a problem playing left field compared to right. I still think he's better off in right field. But he seems to be staying in left. So that's about it.
You mentioned Ryan Zimmerman. He's an interesting question to me. Mm-hmm. And look, we're talking a lot about next year, and we'll talk a little about this year, because this is still a race. But Zimmerman's an interesting question to me, because he really showed some great signs for a while there before he got hurt again and started looking like the hitter that he was a few years back and like a guy you'd put in the middle of a championship lineup. But he's again missing time, and as my friend Will Carroll says, health is a skill. These are really had a really hard time displaying that skill, and so the question to me is, as they go into this winter, do they just slot Ryan Zimmerman in and say, this guy's our first baseman and first base is taken care of, or do they have to say, Ryan Zimmerman is a question, and we've got to find ways to cover for it when we do without him for extended parts of next year?
It's a combination of both, Matthew. You know, it's funny you asked me this, because last week I did a story on Ryan Zimmerman, and he told me he has to change his workout routine because, you know, he had the foot problems, you know, and now he has the oblique problem. He said he's going to have to change the way he does things, maybe not lift weights like he used to, maybe do a little bit more running. So I think he plans to change his exercise routine, and I think it'll be a different story. Because, Matthew, there's no question about it. You know, it looked like Ryan Zimmerman was going to have another bad year based on the batting average. But if you look at the runs, this guy drove in 73 runs and missed all that time. I mean, had he stayed healthy, he had a chance to drive in 100 runs in so little time. So I think Ryan Zimmerman is going to be the first baseman without a doubt, because the guy can still drive in runs. He's not allergic to RBIs. But I think that in terms of his workout routine, it definitely has to change. He even said that. So that has to change.
Mark, some scary and odd stuff going on with Mike Foltynewicz here recently. A couple of things you don't normally see in the injury report. How is he doing, and what's the short-term prognosis on him?
Well, you know, this is very unfortunate. You know, if this occurred to Mike, touch briefly on what has occurred over the last month. He had the pneumonia. Came back. He was getting ready to pitch here at some point this week, but late last week they found the blood clots there in his right arm, and then he had to undergo the procedure where a portion of his rib was removed. And he's recovering, and they do expect him to stay on blood thinners here for another few weeks. And this is not something new. We've seen this with some other pitchers. Alex Cobb underwent something similar just a few years ago. But the hope is that by the start of spring training next year, he will be ready to pitch. And the most important thing is, you know, his health. And that was certainly a scary thing. They were very fortunate to find it when they did. You know, had he gotten on the plane and gone to New York without it being found, there's just things that you don't even want to think about, you know, that extend beyond the fact that he hasn't been able to pitch this past month, which is unfortunate. But the Braves are hoping that by the start, you know, he'll be able to at some point during the winter start his normal preseason preparations, and then be ready for the start of spring training. And at that point in time, we'll get back to that argument of, is he a starter or is he a reliever? And yes, it would have been nice to spend this final month getting a little more data to collect and maybe give the Braves a sense of which direction they want to go. But, you know, at the same time, like I said, the most important thing is his health. And from all indications are he will get out of the hospital at some point, probably later this Thursday here, and then get back to get on the road to health.
So not to ask you to play physician or anything, but How is this something that gets discovered? I mean, it's such an unusual and odd thing. Did he feel some pain, or how is this something that they find out and are able to deal with?
You know, he reported to Turner Field there last week, the Friday, during the final homestand there, the most recent homestand there. And when he arrived at the stadium, he had some swelling and some redness in his arm, and immediately the trainers recognized the symptoms quick enough that they rushed him to the emergency room. And I think it was simply, you know, here's a guy who he had a little bit of discomfort that wasn't normal with simply throwing. Let's put it that way. And the redness in his arm, the swelling, they were able to fortunately get him to a hospital really quickly. Because, you know, like I said, I touched on it earlier, you don't want to, you know, think about what might have happened, but this was something they were very fortunate to diagnose before he got on a plane, started traveling, got away. And it very fortunately, he went to them and said, hey, look, take a look at this. So, but like I said, it's not uncommon. He's not the first pitcher that's done this, or even the first athlete. That portion of the rib is, you know, something that was not something that's going to affect him, but now he'll be able to throw at the beginning of next year. That is the hope.
All right. So I actually went and sat in the stands and saw the doggies in the ballpark the other day, and thought I might see a no-hitter or a perfect game. Julio Teheran was really dealing, and it has continued a streak of him pitching really well for quite a while here now. If there's one thing that we have established doing MLB.com Extras Braves, it's that anytime we talk about Julio Teheran, whatever he is doing that we talk about, he stops doing it. So we are about to jinx him. I just say that now. We're about to end his hot streak here. But this seems a little longer, and it seems a little different. One, do you think that's true? Do you think this is different from some of these earlier spurts? Two, if so, why?
Yeah, I think we can even go back to August 1st. This is not just a couple-week thing. I think this is going on about 2 months where we have seen the Julio Teheran of old. And there was one bad start against the Yankees in there. Other than that, his last 9 or 10 starts, that there hasn't been some promise. Now, what has happened is we've continued to say he's taken a more aggressive approach. He's once again commanding on the inner third of the plate, getting guys back off the plate, which has made the slider more effective. What had helped him do that is he adjusted to the first base side of the rubber there in late July. Alex Wood had done something similar right after the All-Star break. It helped Alex, and Julio followed suit, and it has helped him as well. You know, this is a guy, I've made it known, you know, I didn't like the Alex Wood trade. If I was going to trade one of the two, I would have traded Teheran. I understand the health concerns about Alex Wood's delivery. But at the same time, you know, if Teheran can continue to do what he's been doing here recently, he is a solid number two or number three. And that's nice to build off of when you've already got Shelby Miller right there in the rotation, who, you know, despite, you know, the win-loss record, which means nothing, he has shown at least the ability to be a top of the rotation guy for many years to come. And but what we've seen with Julio, I think just getting command of that inner third of the plate again has made that slider effective. He will have to work on something to have more success against left-handed batters in the future. But other than that, you have to like what you've seen from him. Like I said, going back to basically August 1st, the start that he made there in Philadelphia.
Joe, you have had an awful lot to cover, even as the season has wound down for a second division club. Most recently, some developments and some non-developments and some maybe developments regarding the manager situation. Who is really a part of this picture? Who is not really a part of this picture? Where does this whole thing stand right now?
Well, it's looking more and more like Dan Jennings may not be part of the picture. Part of him would like to still manage or at least discuss that. I think they've already decided that they want to go in another direction. And there's real question of whether or not he will be even returning to the front office, where many have assumed he would just go slide back and be the GM. So, you know, Manny Acta was in town the other day, from what I understand, was here, interviewed for the job, and there are going to be numerous other candidates as well. Guys with previous experience are at the top of that list, and, you know, I think once they kind of sort out how the front office all falls into place, who's going to be the best fit. And I will say this, if Dan Jennings is not with the organization, there might be a bit more turnover in terms of roster than I believe if he stays in the organization, meaning I think he believes more in the core, while a new regime may be a little more skeptical of the core. And the manager is going to be, the next manager is going to be a very important hire. There's no question. I mean, we saw what Joe Maddon brought, you know, to Chicago. And, you know, the Marlins right now, I think they're moving towards being more analytical. Now, you know, how much of that they will do, I believe they will create, instead of, you know, one person being kind of in charge of it, a department. How much, you know, that front office mentality and how much analytics apply to the manager will be very crucial in that decision, and who they feel will be the right fit, because they clearly are going to want somebody on the same page with upstairs. I think Jim Riggleman, who I reported on very early in the process, you know, several months ago, he's been on a short list for at least a couple of months. So I have to assume he's going to get real serious interest. Dusty Baker, was mentioned when Mike Redman was replaced, and he still may or may not, although I hear right now he is not part of the picture, but you never know how things can change. But assuming he is not, you know, you have Manny Acton, like I said, just interviewed. I don't know how serious that will be. But what I've been told, there will be many people probably interviewing for the job. So, again, I think it's going to be the most important offseason hire they or decision they make, maybe even more than, you know, personnel, because it will establish a direction and a philosophy.
If they don't entirely know what the front office is going to look like, then from just a practical nuts and bolts perspective, who's doing the interviews? I mean, is this ultimately just going to be the owner's call, or what's the kind of process as they try and settle on a manager without a front office that's settled?
Well, you have Michael Hill as president of baseball ops. That's what he's been. Mike Berger, who has been the assistant GM, has had a lot stronger voice in you know, since DJ has been down in the dugout, and Jeff McAvoy. He was a real, you know, rising star in the industry, and he's a guy I think to be the new GM if DJ is not the GM. So, you know, they're going to have, you know, you're pretty much going to have people who are already in place. I don't see them going outside the organization like the Brewers just did or some of these other teams. And I think Jennings will land on his feet fairly fast if he does not return here. There was a meeting in New York on Monday. Now, this is Marlins off day. They came back from road trip. Dan Jennings was not there, but a lot of front office types were in New York meeting with Jeffrey Loria. And I think they already know pretty much where they're headed. So this is going to be it's going to be an interesting final, you know, 10-ish games. And we'll see if somehow Dan Jennings stays on the organization. He is signed through 18, so. Who knows, if the season ends, they may just say, hey, let's talk. And if everyone kind of gets on the same page, you might have, you know, a little change in philosophy. As of now, I don't necessarily see that happening. I wouldn't be surprised if Dan Jennings, who's been here, what, since 2002 or 2003, will not be with the organization after this year.
Todd, what we sort of knew was coming was made official recently as Pete McCannon was formally named as the manager of the 2016 Phillies. We kind of broke that down a lot, so I kind of wanted to get more into some of the other things that were talked about that day. And notably, one of the topics that you reported on was the hunt for a general manager. How's that coming? What's the latest on them searching for the right guy to be the general manager?
Yeah, Andy McPhail said the other day that he has interviewed one candidate. He declined to name who that candidate is, but he says it is just in kind of the preliminary stages. He basically said it's going to begin in earnest pretty much after the season is over, and I'm not sure why that is, because but he did know. He said, listen, like, I understand there are a lot of teams out there actively interviewing multiple candidates right now for GM, but Andy doesn't seem concerned about it. He essentially said, listen, I think there's a lot of qualified people out there. There's a lot of talented people out there that could help us, so I don't feel like I need to step up my game. I don't feel like I need to rush through interviews and hire somebody within the next week or two or risk not being able to find a competent general manager. So he seems pretty certain that he'll be able to find a guy that he likes, but he is going to take his time with it. And I asked him, do you think it's a possibility you can still find somebody before the organizational meetings, which begin October 26th? He said, I think it's ambitious. But that does remain our goal. So we'll see if he actually can get it done by then.
We've talked some about what they might be looking for, and they've given some hints, but I would say not a whole lot, sort of talked in fairly vague terms. Do you get any more read as this goes along what they're looking for, just as far as a profile, as far as experience, as far as preferences, just that kind of thing? Do you get any more of a read as this goes along what they want in that person?
I still think it is going to be somebody on the younger side of things, a more analytical type of guy. You know, a lot of people have said, hey, you know, Jim Henry worked for Andy with the Cubs. And, you know, so don't be surprised if he's a candidate. And he might become a candidate. And who knows? Maybe Andy McPhail goes in that direction. But I guess I would be surprised if it went that way. I still feel like, based off of what Phillies owner John Middleton said, which was, I want you to hire
the version of yourself in Minnesota when you were a young, modern thinking up-and-comer. I want you to hire yourself, basically. I think that's the way Andy's going to lean. I wrote in June, Matt Klentak, the assistant GM of the Angels. A lot of people, even at that time, were saying, if Andy does come aboard, look out for Matt Klentak, because he's a young guy that Andy hired when Andy was with the Orioles. They remain close. He kind of fits that mold. And so if I had to throw just a name out there, I think he'd be a guy that some people should keep an eye on.
Putting aside the sort of analytics, stat scouting thing, a name like Hendry seems really strange to me for this reason. I'm curious what you think about this. This is a structure where we seem to be seeing more and more, where you have this president of baseball operations. I don't think that's McPhail's title, but where essentially you have this a senior baseball person, and then you hire a GM under that person. And it just seems to me that if you're talking about somebody like Jim Hendry or Dan Duquette or any of those kind of guys who have been a GM, who have had that they're probably not going to want to work in that kind of scenario. Not that McPhail is a bad guy to work for by any means, but it just seems to me that by the very nature of the structure, you are probably hiring somebody with less experience, somebody who is going to be willing to defer at times and sort of not be the clear number one, but part of a group. I mean, do you think that's an accurate read?
I absolutely think that's an accurate read. Now, you know, that question was asked at the news conference when they announced that Ruben Amaro wasn't coming back. And Andy said, listen, I understand that this is kind of how things work. But he's like, I do give my GM a lot of leeway, a lot of autonomy to kind of do what he wants. And that might be true. But when it comes down to it, the guy that's giving the thumbs up or the thumbs down to free agent signings, significant trades, hiring, firing of managers and whatnot, it's going to be Andy McPhail, no matter how they slice and dice it. You know, Pat Gillick this year as Phillies president, he kept saying, like, listen, Ruben is totally making the call on everything. It's ultimately Ruben's decision. He's the general manager. But that wasn't true. it was Pat Gillick, again, is kind of like the emperor. You remember Gladiator. He was going thumbs up, thumbs down, yay, nay to a trade. And that's what Andy McPhail is going to be. So he's going to kind of oversee everything. He says he's going to give his GM some leeway. And I think what that means is, you know, he's going to let him work as much as, you know, he's going to let him kind of do a lot of things that he wants to do. He's going to let him think how he wants to think. But in the end, you know, Andy's going to be that guy. And that's why I think a guy like a Hendry doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense, or Duquette or somebody along those lines.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks for listening.